Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, and my guest this week is pianist, composer, arranger, educator, historian, Pam Wise. Thanks for coming to the show today, Pam.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Glad to see that you're here. Glad that you're doing well, and we'll spend some of this COVID time talking about music and talking about the things that make you the musician that you are. And tell me, what started you on the trek to being a pianist and a composer? Was it in your household when you were growing up? Were you surrounded by music, or are you the odd fish in the family, or how did that all come about?
I am the odd fish in the family, but yeah, it was probably because of music. No, my dad was a jazz musician. He played upright bass and he had his own jazz trio in addition to being the world star postman in our little small town. So that's how I got the music bug, because he was always rehearsing his trio in the basement. And so I was always sneaking down there and as a toddler. And, oh, man, that's what I want to do. That's really cool. So that's how I got the music. And yeah, and then he was always active in church and he showed me a few things on the piano. And then he said, oh, she catches on pretty quick, the things I'm showing her. So my mother was the one who was like, we need to get her some piano lessons. And so I started taking lessons. I started playing in church. My father was the choir director at church for the senior and youth choir. So that's where I got a lot of my skills. There was an older lady at church that her name was Mrs. Guy. And she also started training me on the pipe organ at church, which was really a scary thing for me because it was this big, huge, monstrosity of a keyboard. And if you hit one of those stops and you don't hit them, it's all, it's like a Mack truck going out of control. But it was really cool because I remember she had me play one Sunday and she made the church take up a collection for me. And I was like, oh, I can make money doing this? Mrs. Yeah, you can make money doing. She said, every time you play, there's a fee that should be charged. And so I think that's how I got the business concept, was from her. And I think I only got like $12 from the collection that Sunday. But hey, in the late 60s, that was a lot of money.
Sure.
You could buy a couple of records, your favorite records. You could buy some baby dolls and the baby doll clothes.
Do a lot with $12.
Yes, we have leftover for candy.
That's right. You can get a lot more candy back than you can now.
Right.
For that little bit of money. No, that's great. So you started in churches and stuff. Did you start your own groups, or how did you get the concept of being a jazz musician and working and getting paid to do the work? But how did that evolve? Did you go to high school and play in bands and things, or did you go to college later, or how did it all
experimented with string instruments? I actually, when I started off on piano, of course, in school, when you got into fourth grade, I met this really hip music teacher. He was a jazz pianist, but he was also our music teacher. So he put a violin in my hand because that's what was available for us fourth graders to play. So I tried that for a while. I didn't like it because it squeaked too much. Then I went to viola. I played that for a while. And then I went from viola to cello, which I really liked, but I didn't like lugging it home from school.
I don't blame you. Big.
It's big, but I wish I would have kept up with it. And I'm thinking that actually, I said, if I ever get a chance to play it again, maybe that's something I might investigate because I love the low voicing of the cello. But after I got in high school, that's when I got the concept of forming a band. I began watching other R&B groups. There was a couple other R&B groups that were really good from my hometown. And after watching them, I started forming my own group. And what was really neat was about the older R&B groups from my hometown helped us out. They helped form our sound and told us what we needed to do. They would come to our rehearsals and make sure that our show was polished and teaching proper vocal technique to the vocalists that were singing with us and instilling the musicians was instilling us of the importance of knowing our instrument, knowing how to read music, knowing how to arrange for R&B group. And we stuck with that. It was called the Ohio Movement. And we did quite a bit of traveling in the states of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. My group stayed together for about 10 years.
What's your hometown?
Steubenville, Ohio is the hometown of Dean Martin. My dad and him went to grade school together, actually. There's a lot of Italians in Ohio. And it actually, there's where a lot of slaves came from the South and migrated north to Ohio.
Wow, so that was a really big learning experience. So you guys are touring already. So what age were you during this time? So this was during your teens or?
Yes, this was during my teens. I would say being a freshman, like we started the band, I think when I was a junior in high school and we were just with gigs around town. And after by the time I graduated, we were traveling. Yeah. So around 17 till I was about 20, 21, something like that. And then I made my move to Cleveland, Ohio. Then I came to Detroit.
Okay. And that was all based on just what was happening in the music scene, how you ended up in Detroit?
Actually, I had an older brother who used to live in Detroit years ago. When he graduated from high school, my mother was looking for him one day. And she said, his name is Craig. She said, where's Craig? I haven't seen him all day. And he saved up like $100 and brought this old raggedy jalopy and drove it to Detroit because he didn't want to be in Steubenville anymore. And we had a friend of ours that lived up here, and it ended up on our friend's doorstep, unannounced. So our friend called my mom and said, well, Craig is up here. And she said, you know what? Tell him he can stay. Because she would know. So her mind was at ease. She knew where he was. She said, I guess he can just stay in Detroit. And he said, after he started continuing his education and got himself together, he said, if I ever get a good job in Detroit, he said he wanted to move back because he left Detroit. He spent about a year up here and had some hard times, and he decided to go back, continue his education. He went to school in Cleveland and in Pittsburgh and went to Hampton Institute in West Virginia. And when he finished his education, he said he wanted to come back to Detroit because he liked Detroit. And so he ended up getting a really good job in Detroit. We were in Cleveland for a while where he worked. And then I moved to Cleveland with him because there was nothing going on in Steubenville. It's such a small town. It's like you could walk from one end of town to the other in 20 minutes. So there wasn't a whole lot going on there. The band was breaking up at that time, and everybody was tired of everybody. Everybody just wanted to grow. And you start thinking about other things, and people wanted to continue their education or whatever it is that they really wanted to do. So I ended up leaving and moving to Cleveland to stay with my brother. And then he got a good job in Detroit, and we came here. We came to Detroit, which was really cool. I was glad that I came. It was hard at first, but after I got acclimated to the city, I was good to go. I had a couple of day jobs. I worked at Blue Cross Blue Shield for a while. I worked at the Bank of the Commonwealth, which was a really good, cool job. It's now known as J.P. Morgan Chase, but a long time ago, went through several transitions. And I think that was one of the most, that was one of my favorite jobs, actually, was working at the bank. I worked downtown and I worked in a bank vault. So like my till was like 1.5 million a day. Even though sometimes I didn't have enough money to eat lunch, looking at all the cash, you couldn't mess with it. But it taught me the importance of money and organizing and things like that. So I was glad that I took that job.
So did you have any time in between to practice or were you playing gigs at night, or
are you looking for gigs at night, basically?
For the first couple of years I was here, I wasn't doing any gigging. I was checking out the music scene. I was going to different places and checking stuff out. But I did have music that I wanted to record. And so I met some other musicians after a couple of years, and I performed with them. It was some R&B groups around that I performed with. But I had my own music that I wanted to record. So after meeting some people, I went to the studio to record some of my tunes, and something happened to their equipment. And Wendell knew these people because he was producing some R&B groups out of that studio. So he came by one day. And
for my audience, this is Wendell Harrison, legendary jazz player here in Detroit. Go on.
Yeah, that's how I met Wendell, because Wendell said, I have a studio and all my stuff is working. So I lugged up and we took my piano over there and I started recording with him. And that's how we hooked up. And he liked my music. Mm-hmm. He said, it's got an R&B flavor, but it's got a great jazz flavor to it, too. We started collaborating on different tunes. And it actually, the relationship turned out to be good, which he's now my husband. And we've been each other for, oh man, since the 80s. And then through Wendell, I met Marcus Belgrave. He was one of the first prominent musicians that I met. And I ended up renting an upstairs flat from Marcus. I stayed with him and his family for a few years. And those chain reaction.
So, composition now. When you first started playing piano, did you immediately start writing your own music, or was it just something that came along with learning how to play, or did that develop separately? How do you approach composition?
It's interesting that you said that, because one of your relatives reminds me of myself. Hannah was my piano student. And after we would do our lessons, when she was about, I guess she was, must have been about 6 or 7 at the time, maybe 8.
Oh, you mean my niece? Yeah, okay.
Hannah. You know, she reminded me so much of me, because she would, after we would do our lessons, she would say, listen to this song that I wrote. When she would play it for me, and that's how I started composing. I would, you know, go through my different piano lessons and stuff I had in my books, but I was always experimenting with my own compositions. And Hannah reminded me so much of myself when she was doing that. And I would tell her mother, I said, man, she might be a great composer one day, because she would always, and we would have to sit there. The lesson was a half an hour, but Hannah would have us there for 45 minutes after the half an hour lesson playing her compositions for us. And I thought that was really cool. I said, oh, she reminds me so much of me. That's how I started composing, noodling around, but like I had the chord structure. And then that's what my dad was saying. Oh, she's got a good sense of chord structure and melody and stuff.
Well, over the years, now, of course, now you've got all these skills and you've learned from playing with everybody else and you've picked up things. And I'm sure you've asked different people, were there different mentors? I mean, you have Wendell to ask a lot of things too, because I know he knows all that theory and arranging. And besides Wendell, how many other mentors did you think you've accessed over the years?
Oh, there were so many, because staying with Marcus, he had a piano in the basement. And he said, you could go down there and practice anytime you wanted. But there was just such a trail of musicians that would come through there. Johnny O'Neill, then you had the Jazz Development Workshop down on Grand River. Roy Brooks would come through. People like Lamont Hamilton, who was a saxophone player who is not with us anymore. Hiroshima Cox, Kenny Cox, even Kenny Garrett. I was around a lot of people who were writing, who was writing and arranging at that time. And even though I didn't feel that I was really that great of a player, I just felt if I kept hanging around the environment, I would learn a lot. And I did. That experience with the Jazz Development Workshop was a thing that Marcus had put together. And Wendell was a part of it. They were teaching jazz classes down there. They had a big band where Johnny Allen taught big band arranging. And it was just a great school and great environment to be in, which I think is lacking today, something that to continue. But yeah, I had a lot of different mentors in Detroit. And Detroit has a certain thing about them where they just take you under their wing and they just show you the way. And I'm still trying to get there, but.
Yeah, I know. How do you know when you've gotten there, right? Wherever there is?
But. Yeah, you never know. It's always, you're always learning. Always.
Yeah.
It's always going to be.
So you're a perpetual student. So when did you start getting students?
I've always, even when I was coming up, I've always had students, because even when I was like taking piano lessons, I would show my other friends. Because you spend time together. Now show me how to do this. Show me how to do that. This is what you're doing. I want to learn how to do it too. You just kind of just do that naturally, I think. And then when I started getting students that would pay me, that wouldn't come until much, much later. But when I came to Detroit, I got involved with a summer youth arts program. That it was a wonderful program. They've been trying to recreate it for years, but they haven't been successful in doing it. But it was a situation where we had all arts disciplines. And I taught this program for about 6 years, where we had jazz and we had creative writing, stage set design, costuming. This was like a 6 to 8 week program. And we all had to come together at the end of this program with a production. So I taught this program for about 6 years for the city of Detroit. And it was a very rewarding experience. And I would say that most of the students that came out of that program are doing some wonderful things now. And that's some good reflection to look back on. So hopefully they can get it going again in some kind of way, but I don't know. Takes a lot to get people on board to manage a situation like that.
So what have you been doing while COVID's been going on?
A lot of practicing. A lot of
practicing. That's good.
A lot of writing, a lot of recording. We had the opportunity to do the Sister Strings for the Detroit Jazz Festival, which was really good. It was virtual, and it was strange for us because we didn't have really a live audience. We just were just streaming, and we didn't really have audience feedback. It was strange because that's what kind of fuels us to go, but I think we did an excellent job with that production. And
yeah, I think we did too.
Yeah. And then I've been recording streaming music for my church, and Wendell just had a CD, new CD that was released that features me and some other Detroit prominent players. And so we have been working on that. I just think the sad part is the economic downturn future for us musicians and artists, and trying to figure out how we're going to fit into this matrix of why this pandemic is going on economically, how we're going to survive and what we have to do to support ourselves as well as support others. It's very questionable at this time.
Have you all done any of the concerts in the living room type thing with chip jars or digital chip jars or anything like that?
No, not yet. We've been still holding what we call, Wendell has these upper room jam sessions. over here at the in our studio, which we have just a couple of other players come over. And it's a learning thing where Wendell teaches jazz improvisation because he's like the guru. So they all seek knowledge. Right. And everybody wants to keep playing. But maybe that we will turn that into some type of streaming thing or tip jar thing. But I'm like, if they don't have any economic stimulus package, people aren't going to be able to afford to... How are they going to support the tip jar when they don't have any money? But
right,
hopefully things will work out. I hope that our country learns a lot, and hopefully we keep voting for responsible people to be in charge of the government. We'll have some type of leadership when it comes to these kind of things, because I think if there was proper leadership, we could have beat the pandemic a long time ago.
True that. True that.
Here we are. The uncertainty of it all is just mind-boggling.
We do what we can. And as I say on this show all the time, I just say our job is to make art and make art and make more art and continue to make art and give people hope in that way. Because that's what we have our skills in. So hopefully this does make a difference for everyone.
Yeah.
And I know it makes a difference for me.
And it's and art is in everything that we do, everything that we look at, every chair that we sit in, every computer that's designed. I don't care what it is. Art is always involved. We have to keep creating.
Let's, you know, talk about some of the things that you have created. Now you have, how many albums do you have right now that you've done, your solo albums?
At five right now.
And five. Okay. That's pretty impressive. And I was going to say that you're heavily influenced on, I guess, Latin styles of playing or Cuban music. Now, where did that come from your history? You talk about the R&B sound and into the mixing into the jazz. Where did the Latin come from?
You know, it was just something that was in me. I've always wanted to trace the music of my ancestors. And I think that's what kind of fueled it. I was always curious about where our music originated from. And so I began researching African rhythms, Afro-Cuban rhythms, the migration of African people to the Americas. And that's how I became interested in that. And after, of course, doing DNA on Ancestry.com, you find all these different elements that were made of. What was curious to me about it is how these traditional African rhythms stayed with us through R&B music, through all types of music, even the dance portion of it. We still carry this with us for thousands of years. And one time I remember a grant project that I got, and I was writing some Afro-Cuban music fused with jazz. But I also met a dancer who later married Francisco Mora, a good friend of mine, which helped me do a lot of research on Afro-Cuban rhythms and jazz music and how it originated and how we fused it together. And I also was curious about the dance portion, because in their culture, the dance, the music, and praise and worship, that's all one thing. It's not separated like we separate things over here. It's just like all one thing. And so I was also researching the dance part of it, and I tore up my knees doing it. But anyway, it was pretty interesting because we staged a thing where we had some hip hop dancing and we had traditional African dance. And we had my friend's wife, who was Afro-Cuban descent, look at it. And she was like, the dances were not different from the traditional Afro-Cuban and what they were doing with the hip hop. It was the same. Huh. It was just that the young people don't know the story behind the different dance moves and things like that. And when the young people found out, they were just really blown away. You know,
I'm pretty blown away by that too. Cause yeah, you just don't you don't realize how connected it all is.
Or why you do it. Why does your body move like that? It's like this history that you've been carrying with you for that's been generated through many years, and you just have no clue of what it is. And I think it's vital for us to know who we are. If you don't know who you are, it's going to be hard to move forward. So it's that Sankofa thing.
I know you're on your Facebook page, you talk a lot about the history of Detroit musicians. So is that something that you're making an effort to, I guess, make more public, is the history of jazz musicians in Detroit? Is there a project in the works for that?
I think a lot of other people do it, like Mark Stryker, who is a prominent writer who has a book out about Detroit jazz history. But I don't think it really tells the whole story. He probably needs several books, but Detroit has such a rich history of putting jazz on the map that I thought that it was important for us not to forget any of them. I've had the pleasure of meeting a few, but there was a lot of them that came before me that Wendell knows that taught him. And so I thought it was important to keep their legacy alive so the people would know who they were. Some people aren't here anymore. People that taught Wendell, trumpeter Lonnie Hilliard, and who took Wendell up under his wing. And because a lot of times when he would go to high school, you get laughed at, stuff like that. Boy, you don't know what you're doing and stuff like that. But certain people just latch on to you and just, hey, man, they teach you how to dress, teach you how to play your instrument and what to do and what not to do. And I think those people always need to be, we need to remember our ancestors and what they've done for us. And the people that are still here that have put Detroit on the map, such as bassist Ron Carter, people like that are very important to our legacy in Detroit jazz. So hopefully maybe a film will come at some point. I'm not a filmmaker, but I think one of the problems that I have with some of the books that have been written about Detroit jazz is they don't capture a lot of the stories. It's just a news report. Oh, this person did that, this person did that. But it doesn't really speak to somebody came into the Bluebird Inn and tried to sit in and this went down. Or how they ended up getting that gig as opposed to another person. I think people want to hear those stories too.
I think you're right. Del, do you have access to those stories? Between you and Wendell, I bet you have a lot of stories to tell.
Wendell's really got most of them at him being, 78 years old. One of the writers was just telling him to just turn on the recorder and just talk, because he's got some really excellent stories to tell. So I think him and Bill Harris might be putting something together soon for that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that, because I'm sure you have stories. It's still, to this day, aren't as many women on the bandstand. And coming up with all those men, how did you navigate that? How did you navigate that?
Actually, it wasn't that bad for me, because a lot of the older guys, they just want to show you. If you're interested in learning what you want to do in terms of learning music, a lot of the older cats were very helpful. Even Roy Brooks, a lot of times he wouldn't be feeling so well. God, he would come down to the workshop and just start playing the piano and just say, look at this. Look at me. Look at what I'm doing. You learn tunes or how to voice a chord. Or I never experienced them being like really rude to me or anything like that. Most of the cats that I met were pretty cool. I didn't really experience any type of heavy negative vibes. Some of them might look at you strange if they didn't know you. If you sit in and be like, oh, I don't know about her. I never heard it. Who are you? But not too much of that. Maybe one or two people, but most of it was pretty positive.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, I don't get a chance to talk to that many women musicians. Just to ask, how was it back then? How was when you started out, and how did things go? And how did you get to where you are? Because a lot of it is word of mouth or auditory, or you're sitting at somebody's lap and listening and say, oh, and asking questions, because that was not my experience. A lot of it was like, just go woodshed by yourself and hope for the best.
Yeah, no, I think myself, Marion came before me, Marion Hayden. And I think Marion had a pretty good experience with guys taking her up under their wing and showing her the way. I think for the most part, we've done pretty good with that. Marion's been doing it a little longer than me, but I think we've gotten pretty good vibes from most of the cats.
Oh, that's good to hear. Very good to hear. Are you working on any new compositions right now?
Yes. Yes, I actually wrote, composed some music. I had a project that I did back in 2019 called Matrix X Detroit, the Gentrification Nation, because our city is changing. And it was like this production thing that involved dance, poetry, and music. And I had a couple of scenes that were acted out. Bill Harris, famous writer, wrote the scenes for me, and we acted them out about the different changes that people go through during the gentrification process, like how some people are pushed out of their homes or having to relocate, or the financial and the economical downturn for some people. Or some people might have worked out okay, but I wrote some compositions in lieu of that. So I need to work on recording them. So that's what I'm doing now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then what was your most recent album?
The most recent was A New Message from the Tribe, which features a lot of prominent Detroit players. And we actually played some of that music on the Sisters with Strings concert. We played Plain Plenty, and I didn't record Uncle Chex's Cha-Cha-Cha. Good Hair did that. Music Noir did that for their Good Hair.
Music Noir?
Yeah.
Music Noir.
Noir. Did that on their CD, which was pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you, too, about, at some point I wanted to do a series about jazz families and you and Wendell in the same house. And how does that all work out? So he has separate projects and you have separate projects, and then you guys have joint projects together sometimes, or?
Yeah.
Or mostly?
Yeah, or because we end up being involved with each other, because even if he has his own project, he's going to be asking me a lot of questions. Pam, how do you do this? And blah, blah, how do you do that? Just like I was pulling them in the studio, trying to get set up for this podcast. My podcast, I got to ask him, how do you do this? How do you do that? And luckily, we have a big house. And during the pandemic, we haven't killed each other yet, so.
Oh, that's cool. So, but when you're all riding together, like I know when he's riding, do you guys separate and go into different rooms and just say, leave me alone, I can't talk to you because I'm riding? Or is it more, yeah, how do you do this and how do you do that? Or listen to this, or how do you do it? I'm just curious, it's because everybody has a different writing technique, so I'm just curious how that works out with two composers in the same house.
No, we don't get in each other's way too much. A lot of times Wendell will have an idea, and after he has it sketched out, he'll ask me what I think. And I'll do the same thing for him. Because a lot of times I might need help with the arrangement and voicings for other instruments and things like that. So he's able to help tremendously with that. Or tell me what sounds good, what voicings sound good for certain instruments and what don't. So I'm always,
sure.
Yeah, I'm always asking him questions, and he always asks me stuff. We don't get in each other's way too much for that. Luckily, like I said, luckily we have a big house, so that helps a lot.
Have you guys ever gotten in a drag out fight about a song?
Yeah, because sometimes he'll come up with an arrangement. I'll tell him I don't like that, and he said, "Well, I think it sounds good for that." And I'll be like, "No, it doesn't. I don't want that." So it won't be a knockout drag out fight, but it'll be kind of heated. Not as heated as him and Marcus and Harold McKinney. Boy, they used to get into some big shouting matches. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. But then all of a sudden, Marcus will say, I think we should play it like this. And everybody will be like, yeah, man, you're right. I think about that trio, and I witnessed in some of their drag out fights. Then it would be just like 15 minutes later, they'd be hollering, screaming, and then everything is like back to normal, like nothing ever happened.
Yeah, from outside looking in, it sounds like somebody's killing each other.
The one that would always bring everything back, and he would just say like one thing, man, we should phrase it like this. They'd be like, yeah, Bill, you got it. So me and Wendell, we aren't that bad. We do have our opinions.
Have your moments.
Yes.
So now, totally different subject. Do you remember the first album you ever bought with your own money?
Yeah, I would say it was might have been the Dramatics.
What you get. Oh yeah.
Album, I think that might have been one of the first ones. There might have been a couple before that, but that's the one that stands out. Mm-hmm. The Dramatic.
And what was like the first really, like when you felt like you really understood jazz, what would be the first album that you bought?
Man, it was funny because my older brother would bring a lot of the jazz music to our house in Steubenville because he was out in the world getting his education and everything. So he would bring albums back by McCoy, John Coltrane, Leon Thomas, different people like that. My father had a lot of jazz records, so we always had jazz in the house. So I never really had to buy that kind of stuff because we already had. Yeah, yeah. My parents were always playing jazz. I think we were listening to Oscar Peterson, all kinds of stuff. I think Oscar was like one of the first pianists that I gravitated to because of his technique was just so off the chain. Then you had Ramsey Lewis. He was a pianist that I liked. That also crossed over from the early jazz years to being popular. And it was just a shame because it just seemed like the radio stations stopped playing certain things. They would categorizing stuff so much. Before, it wasn't a big thing. Like, you could turn on a black radio station and you just heard black music, whether it was jazz, R&B. If it was good stuff, they played it. They might play it at different times of the day. They might have a time where they play more jazz than they would play R&B. But if it was good music, they just played it. But now you have all this categorizing stuff. This smooth jazz, this kind of jazz. This,
right.
You know. So that, I think that just kind of changed the way we look at music now, or the way we listen to it. And when I was coming up, we had like listening parties. You would have people with great album collections, and you would go to each other's house and just listen to music, do that quite a bit. And nobody said a whole lot. There wasn't a whole lot of conversation going on. You just sat down and person would put on their record list. This is what I picked up today. It might have been Chick Corea's Return to Forever, latest album or something, which was really cool. People don't do that. People don't do that anymore. Of course, there was less TV then.
Yeah, it makes a difference. Makes a difference. Also, that now everything is, even back in the day, they had 45s a lot of the time. So if you didn't have the long play record,
right,
you had a 45. And we're doing that with tracks now. The streaming downloads are just, you can buy one track. Or you don't ever have to listen to the whole album if you don't want to. And then there's places where you don't have to buy anything and listen to the whole thing as much as you want.
So, yeah, economically, I would say, because if you think about it, when you bought a 45 back in the day, you had the A and B side, and you might have paid $1 for two songs for the A and B side. Of course, you brought it mainly for the song that you heard on the radio the most. And then occasionally you might play the B side and say, oh, I like that too. But if you think about monetarily of what you paid for that back in the day, back in the 60s or whatever, and what people buy a track for now, that's really not that much difference.
It's the more we change, the more we stay the same.
Exactly. That sounds like a good song title, actually.
You know, because we do get to the same, it's just a new technology, the same way of doing things, but just a new technology.
Yeah. Right, you're right. I'm saying that maybe we should be charging $2 for a track instead of just $1.
Try it and see what happens.
Yeah.
What would be your desert island disc now? Like, if you were stuck on a desert island, what five discs would you take?
What five discs would I take? Oh, I would definitely take some McCoy Tyner. I'd probably take all of his stuff. Yeah. I just love Baba McCoy Tyner. To me, he was one of the most innovative players that had a special gift in terms of the way he improvised, developing his own style. I know he spent a lot of his early days with John Coltrane, which he was very appreciative of that because it brought some other things out in his playing that he was able to carry with him. So I would say that in terms of pianist, and I would take five of his discs on a island for sure.
And call it good.
Yes. That's right.
So, all right. I don't have any more random questions, but I just wanted to. I was just curious as to what your sound, inner soundscape was going to. The soundtrack of your life is McCoy Tyner. So,
but I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How well did you know your uncle, Roland?
I did not get to know him until I moved to New York in my 30s. And then I did get to see him very often because they lived in upstate New York and I was in Brooklyn. So I got a couple of maybe two or three Thanksgivings with them. And he did a couple of concerts down in New York, and I got to go and see him at those concerts and talk to him and hang out a little bit after, but not a lot. I didn't get to know him very well.
Yeah.
Because we were in Detroit and he was in New York and traveling all over the world, and I just didn't get to know him. My dad's family was just not close.
Yeah.
They never were. So I really didn't get to know him very well. But I got to play violin with him, and he was playing cello.
Oh, wow. Because
he was a cellist.
Yeah.
I got to play with him one time at Thanksgiving, and I'm just like, and I was laughing. I was like, so I finally get to play with you, and you're not even playing piano. I was kind of ticked off. I'm practicing my jazz and stuff, and I'm like, ooh, I get to play with Uncle Roland. Not, you know.
But at least you got to spend some time with him, I'm sure.
Exactly.
That was.
But yeah, I didn't get to know him. The first thing he told me, because I was asking him, at the time, I think I had a teacher who was saying, you should learn 50 tunes and play them on all 12 keys.
Okay.
And he said, no, just learn 5. And play them, because he says, I'm playing some of the same tunes I've been playing for 40 years.
Yeah, yeah. And he's probably right, because if he learned 5 good tunes and transpose them, that would give you a good footing for what you needed to know. I agree.
Yeah. And it depends on the tunes, because if you learn some tunes, those changes are used on 25 songs. So if you learn those changes, then every other tune. Yeah. But he didn't go into that much detail. I had to find that out later. Did you freeze on me? You froze on me.
We had some technical difficulties, so while we get her back online, listen to one of her tunes called Blues for Mary Lou.
Pam, so where can people find you online?
You can go to my website, PamelaWiseMusicKeys.com, and all my releases and stuff is on YouTube, all digital platforms. Bandcamp is something that I just recently put a lot of stuff up on. So you can check out Bandcamp, Apple Music, YouTube, Spotify, all of that good stuff.
Thank you so very much for being on my show today and sharing your wisdom and your history and your skills and your wonderful self with us today.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome that you started doing the podcast. And I think these are new grounds that we have to dive into during the pandemic. That was a great idea.
Yeah, it's been a fun idea. So I'm get a chance to talk with people like you. So thank you so much. And we'll see everybody next time on Tia Time.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website, TiaViolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating wherever you listen to podcasts. We really appreciate your comments and will mind them to bring you more amazing episodes.
I would like to thank this inaugural season sponsors, the folks at Jazz Lines of Bend, Michigan, or JAM. Michigan Art Share, a program of Michigan State University Extension, is a partner in supporting the Tia Time podcast and Sham Bones Music. Without their support, this podcast would not be possible. Thank you so much. If you would also like to contribute to the show, you can find us on Patreon.com.
If you want to continue the conversation about topics discussed in the show or start new ones with like-minded people, join us at the Tia Time Lounge on Facebook. Thank you for listening. See you next week at Tia Time.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at TiaViolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tia Time.